Welcome to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. Whether your family has been on this journey for years or you're just getting started, we're here to support and encourage you along the way. And now your hosts, Lynette Ezell and Tara Melber.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're really excited to welcome Katie Smith to the podcast. Katie is a licensed clinical social worker and a play therapist, and she works primarily with children, adolescents, and adult women who are recovering from experiences of complex developmental trauma. The best part for us, for Lynette and me, is that Katie owns Arbor Cove Therapy and practices really near us in Roswell, Georgia. Yeah. So welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you because we know that you integrate lots of different treatments like EMDR, that'd be something for people to Google really quick, and TheraPlay and TBRI, which we've talked about in the past, that you integrate that with your client's faith because you really believe as a Christian that we're designed to move toward healing in the deepest parts of who God created us to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so today we just want to focus, Katie, on secondary trauma, focus on secondary trauma. And it'd be really helpful to me and my family, to Tara and her family, to our listeners, for you to describe to us what secondary trauma truly is.
Sure. So secondary traumatic stress is a term that originally came about as people were studying what happens to people like myself. So people in the helping professions, like first responders, therapists, medical professionals, as a result of just repeated exposure to taking care of others who have experienced trauma. And so it's defined as taking on symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of repeated exposure to either hearing about the experiences of someone who has been traumatized or caregiving. That kind of day-to-day, not really getting a break kind of exposure, either through what you hear about or just trying to help when someone's experiencing that.
So for every single adoptive mom and foster parent
who have kids 24/7, that would seem like it would be an appropriate term for those parents,
yes,
for sure.
Definitely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I've not thought about the therapist sitting there listening to this every single day.
Yeah, that was my first kind of learning about this was when I was working at an agency within the context of child welfare services. And I was at a conference where someone presented on this, and it was like, oh, well, it makes sense then.
Exactly.
Why, after a really bad day, like, I want to go home, and I think one time I actually did go home and eat a whole bag of, like, Werther's Caramels or something. Yeah. Not my finest moment, but, like, why we do some of these things to try to cope with, like, what we're taking home with us on a daily basis if we're exposed to this in our job. And then the more I worked with foster and adoptive families, the more I was just kind of perplexed about the lack of information about this that was going out to them. I feel like as professionals, we're pretty familiar now with these terms of secondary traumatic stress or vicarious trauma. But there's not a lot out there for foster and adoptive parents. And as I thought about it, I thought, well, gosh, you know, like if we're kind of picking up symptoms of post-traumatic stress just from working, you know, an 8 to 10 hour day with people, what must this be like? It has to be just rampant and chronic for families who are living this, you know, on a daily basis, trying to care for someone who's healing from these experiences.
You know, I remember one time the headmaster at a school, a little private school where one of my children were attending at the time, we're not there anymore, but we're attending, he called me to talk to me about test scores. It was a good call, but I was anticipating
the
bad call. Right. But we had just had a bad, but you know, summer can be because you lose your schedule and, you know, and these kids really need
structure.
Structure, yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. And I need structure. In the summer, all that's out the window, you know? And he called me and I just start weeping. And, you know, and that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, and you kind of develop that same filter that someone who's experienced trauma develops where your default is to look for threat, expect threat. There's that negative filter. That's one of the kind of symptom clusters of post-traumatic stress disorder is negative cognitions and mood, which is basically just like a negative filter in terms of how you view the world, going from viewing it as predominantly a pretty safe place on most days to a predominantly you know, threatening place or dangerous place.
So it's beyond an Eeyore mentality. It's deeper than that. Yeah.
Well, it's just something that kind of becomes your default, which I guess is similar to kind of that Eeyore mentality. But a lot of times I think what happens is, whether as professionals or parents, we start to beat ourselves up about that or get really freaked out about that. Like, you know, I look in the mirror and I think, where did I go? Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't who I was when we started this journey. And so that must mean that there's something wrong with me, that I'm having, you know, I wake up every day and, you know, I just kind of have this negative expectation.
Waiting for the ball to drop.
Yeah, like what's going to happen
because
with my kids.
Because it has 50 times before.
Right.
Right. You know? Yeah, and that's the thing is it's not without reason. Mm-hmm. You know, you've had a lot of negative calls from the school or, you know, you've had some days that have really gone sideways and, you know, or you've had to pick up the pieces of a child's dysregulation or stuff at home getting broken or fights breaking out or whatever it is. You know, you had a lot of negative experiences that have formed that template where out of a desire for just self-protection, you start kind of defaulting to starting the day with your walls already up. And it's a potential point of connection with the children in your parenting that have experienced trauma because, my goodness, you know, what a point of empathy. Like, oh, right. Well, it makes sense, you know, why they're maybe going to school already kind of ready for a fight, you know, or seeming that way because they've had a ton of negative experiences in their life with other people. And so it makes sense that they have that default. And so now I'm experiencing a little bit of what that feels like because it's happening to me too. But sometimes when people just feel like they're having a lot of these symptoms, you know, they're more irritable than they used to be or they're having trouble sleeping or they don't want to be around their child. You know, all of those things, if they feel like they're just kind of this scattershot kind of cluster of symptoms, it can really trigger a lot of shame and a lot of self-criticism. Whereas one of the reasons why I love talking about this with families is, you know, to see them have that moment of realization of like, oh my gosh, you know, this is a thing. Like this is something that makes some more sense to me now. And especially when we talk about what causes it, it really normalizes it for families and helps them kind of shift at least out of the shame that I think keeps us stuck.
How long does it take typically when you're working with a child or an adolescent that's a foster or adoptive child and you're with a parent, how long before you see that they feel comfortable talking to you? Or when you start to see them say, I just feel irritable all the time. I wish that this has really messed up my whole entire life. This is not what I was expecting. All of those things that nobody wants to say out loud.
I don't want this chapter in our story.
Right.
Is what we hear.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great way to put that. You know, it really varies. I have some families that come in and they're just so in crisis by the time they walk through the door that they're just very, like, laying it all out on the table and very transparent because they kind of have to be.
Right.
Like, they're just at that breaking point. So that happens a lot. And then sometimes there are families who, you know, they're still really trying to put the good face on it and do the best they can and soldier on, and especially if they're struggling with a lot of shame and they may be hesitant. So really what I've started doing is when I start working with a family, whether it's I'm working with the mom or I'm working with the child, right from the get-go in our initial assessment, I just go ahead and ask about it.
Oh,
or I'll
that's good.
Kind of put it out there and say, you know, a lot of the parents that I see, they struggle with this, or they kind of feel like sometimes they really regret that they started this journey to begin with, or they really have a lot of criticism of themselves. You know, what has been your experience with that? And a lot of times just bringing that into the room, just tears will come.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can have that conversation and start really working on that. We also have a monthly support group at our practice where moms, well, it's open to parents, but right now we've just had moms coming. Moms can come, and I think just knowing that there's a group like that out there kind of normalizes it. So I'm like, oh, you know, other people are struggling with this too, and there's this place where I can go and just really talk in an open and honest environment and get support and not have people look at me, you know, like, what?
Right.
And so that seems to really help bring a lot of transparency.
So you mentioned some of the symptoms of secondary or vicarious trauma that people would experience. Would that kind of epitomize all of that? Is that irritability and maybe regret, feeling regret or guilt and shame? Are there other symptoms that we could be looking for in our own lives?
So when we think about post-traumatic stress disorder, there's four symptom clusters. One is symptoms of intrusion. So that within the context of talking about secondary traumatic stress, what that can look like is thoughts about the trauma that your child experienced kind of popping up in your head when you don't expect them to, when you don't want them to. You're just going about your day and you just start having these thoughts.
So you make a mental picture of maybe what your child went through, you think? Yeah.
But it just pops in your head randomly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just comes up at like...
I can relate to that.
The worst possible time.
Yes.
Right.
The worst possible
time. Right. Yes. Exactly.
Not that we have personal experience.
No. Yeah, we do. You read about this. Yeah. So symptoms like that. Avoidance. So, you know, for someone who has PTSD, that's avoiding reminders of the traumatic thing that happened to them. So for someone experiencing secondary traumatic stress, a lot of times this is where that whole piece of, like, as much as I hate to admit it, like, I really just wish my child would, you know, be at after school for, like, 2 weeks solid or, you know, whatever it is, you know, just really wanting to avoid your child. Because there's just so much going on for them as a result of their trauma that has become traumatic for you. The parent feels overwhelmed, or a parent feels rejected, or a parent feels a sense of hopelessness. And so all of those emotions are getting triggered by their child, or not really shouldn't say by their child, but by the behaviors and emotions that their child is struggling with. And so the parent kind of starts, without even necessarily realizing it, kind of avoiding, you know, spending less time with that child or keeping them at arm's bay a little bit.
Katie, can I? So you talk about maybe the parent feels like they need space from the child. And so we know that there are residential treatment centers and those sorts of things.
Right.
Don't you think there's a time and place for that at some point?
You know, I do. I'm very, very hesitant to recommend residential treatment. In fact, I think there's only been one time in the last 3 years that I've been in private practice that I've, you know, really felt like we needed to go that direction. And it was when, you know, the alternative seemed to be disruption, you know.
Yes.
And but I do think so. And sometimes and usually when I think that way, it's because of this dynamic. And, you know, when everything else we've tried just doesn't seem to be able to be breaking the parent and child out of this dynamic where they just seem to be constantly kind of triggering each other. And there's, you know, almost a concern that the child is more being re-traumatized more because of feeling rejected by the parent or by other members of the family than they would be by going to something like residential treatment.
Gotcha.
For a while. And so it kind of gives everybody a break and a chance to kind of interrupt this loop.
But you could utilize even respite for something, just to give breaks or that kind of thing for parents, just to kind of regroup.
Absolutely. And that's something that I encourage parents to do all the time.
Right.
Is definitely, you know, look for respite, even if it's just, you know, a date night occasionally, or even if it's just a couple of hours. You know, can you, you know, take more advantage of after-school programs? Or, you know, is there a caregiver that can come in and just be with this child for a few hours in the afternoon, even if it's just to help them with their homework? You know, because that's such a common kind of ground for blow-ups.
Right.
So anything like that that gives parent a break, I'm a huge fan of. I think it's so important.
Yeah, and you know, there are times a friend of mine had to do it because of security. I mean, just to keep everyone in the home safe. And so
that's a great point. Safety issues, certainly.
Yeah.
That becomes a big issue.
Right.
So we have intrusion and avoidance. What's another one?
So another one is what I mentioned earlier, and that's the negative mood and cognition. So getting to that point where you just develop a predominantly negative view of yourself, of others, and of the world. You know, and oftentimes that feels like just always feeling like you're on edge, or you just expect the worst to happen, or you expect the worst of yourself or other people. It's kind of where that shame kind of falls into that umbrella. And then the last major symptom cluster is arousal or reactivity. And that's talking about symptoms like, you know, just your heart racing, kind of feelings of panic almost, but just feeling really worked up or irritable, like really keyed up and anxious, difficulty sleeping, all of those things kind of fall into that. So that idea that, again, being exposed to the trauma that your child experienced or just being around your child kind of causes this reactivity in your body.
Because the body truly keeps the score. We know
right.
that. So.
Right, absolutely. So, okay, so what in the world do we do about all that?
Well, I was thinking about
you're thinking about my symptoms.
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest things is just kind of understanding what's going on, again, kind of at the body level, because that can really help make it make more sense and kind of take the shame out of it, like there's something wrong with me, and shifting it, just like Bruce Perry talks about, kind of shifting our understanding of people who've experienced trauma from, you know, what's wrong with you to what happened to you.
Right. And I like that quote.
Yeah. And I think when we can have that perspective on our children, but also on ourselves, you know, like there's not anything wrong with me. It's that, you know, this trauma has kind of entered into the life of this child that I love. And as a result, into our family, as we kind of become the container for them to work out their healing, that we are actually having very normal reactions to an abnormal thing that should have never happened to this child, but it did. And the way we're reacting to it is actually really normal. So I think that's really the first thing to do to kind of start moving towards healing, because that really determines the trajectory of our decision-making and what we do. You know, we're going to respond in very different ways if we're blaming ourselves versus looking at it as more of like a neurobiological response to trauma. There's a really good book that Daniel Hughes wrote called Brain-Based Parenting. I don't necessarily recommend it to all of my clients because it's very clinical and detailed and kind of dry, but it's helpful in terms of the basic concept of it and understanding this, because he and his co-writer, Jonathan Baylin, talk about what is going on in the body when we parent, and they talk about five pathways that really have to be online. So they talk about there's the parental approach system, which basically means feeling like parenting is safe. So feeling like you can approach your child and that you're going to be welcomed and not rejected and certainly not assaulted or attacked, you know, like what happens in some families. But that just you can approach this child and engage with them however you need to. Then there's the parental child reading system, which is basically this child makes sense to me. So feeling like the child is cueing you accurately, you know, when they're upset, that means that they need a hug, or when they're withdrawn, that means they're sad. You know, all of those things that, you know, we come to expect, whether that's just from what we know about child development or parenting children who haven't experienced trauma, you know, we have that template then of like, this is how this child makes sense to me. And we apply that to a child that's experienced trauma. And sometimes we don't read this new child accurately, you know, or they're miscuing because of their past experiences.
Wow, how could you not? That's such a great point, because you know, you didn't, it could be years. I mean, you get an older child, you've missed.
Right.
So much, you miss all that gleaning of all of that.
Mm-hmm. And their cues that they've given have had to be a certain way to protect themselves.
Absolutely. Right. So they're survival mode.
Right. So they're survival cues, not necessarily what you would think would be typical.
Right. Absolutely. There's also the parental meaning-making system, which is just parenting makes sense, you know? So, like, I understand why I'm doing this. And sometimes, again, that kind of goes sideways when you're parenting someone who is trying to heal from trauma. You know, things don't always make sense the way that you think that they will. And then there's the, parental reward system, which is basically parenting satisfying. You know, like I feel good.
Yeah, this
you
is
know,
good. We're walking in relationship, and this is working.
I feel like we're connected. I feel like I'm doing what I felt like I was called to do from the very beginning. I feel like we're making some progress. I feel like this child is healing some. And that's kind of hitting on, like, our dopamine system.
Right.
Like, you know, we release this neurotransmitter dopamine whenever we have a sense of, like, getting a reward for something. And so when this system is offline or getting continually blocked, we're not getting that. And then there's the parental executive system, which is kind of like the control center for the other four. And so all of these things are working in conjunction. And the other part of our just our physical being that gets kind of knocked offline when this isn't working properly is that parental approach system. When we feel like we can't approach the child, touch the child, you know, engage in any of those kind of activities of, like, closeness, our oxytocin gets affected, which is the hormone, kind of they call it the love hormone, that gets released when we feel like or when we are able to be really physically close with someone and give them a hug or talk with each other in a really warm, soft tone, all of that. And so when that gets knocked offline, just again, from a biological perspective, if we don't have the oxytocin we need and the dopamine that we need, then we're not going to be the parents that we would like to be. You know, we're going to go into that mode of threat avoidance versus safety and approach. But it's a physical thing. That's happening to us.
You know, Katie, all this conversation about secondary trauma is fascinating, and we've never covered this on the podcast before. So we'd appreciate it if you would just hang tight, and we would love to continue recording with you so that we can do a part two to this fascinating conversation.
You have been listening to the Adopting and Fostering Home, a resource of the North American Mission Board. For more information about today's podcast and other relevant resources, visit sendrelief.org.